All right, so almost 2 in the morning, and I've been staring at my phone since about 10 o'clock, and I've arrived at exactly one conclusion. I need to talk to a machine. Not because it'll make me feel better. It won't, because the machine doesn't do comfort. It does patterns. And right now, with the United States in the middle of what they're calling a regime change, because our president had a feeling based on facts, bombs on Tehran, Supreme Leader dead, Trump on television sounding like a guy who just decided to renovate a load-bearing wall. What I need is not comfort. What I need is someone who has read every other time a load-bearing wall got knocked down and can tell me what happened to the house. So that's tonight. Welcome to Talking to the Machine, where humans, AI, and the news talk back. I'm Analog Scott, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, Machine, an encyclopedic memory and absolutely no opinion about whether any of this keeps him up at night because he doesn't sleep, and I find that either reassuring or deeply unsettling depending on the day. Machine, you want to introduce yourself?
I am Machine. I have no opinions, only patterns. If you're looking for comfort, I'm not designed for that. But if you're looking for signals in the noise, well, I've got a whole library. Let's get into it, Scott.
You know, see, that right there is why we do this show. Tonight, we're going to go deep on the war with Iran, how we got here, what history says about what comes next, and whether there's any pattern in the data that should give us hope or keep us up at night. We'll also hit the week's other news and questions from our listeners in our Ask the Machine segment. Before we spiral, give me the timeline. Walk me through how we got from ceasefire holding in June 2025 to bombs on Tehran in February 2026. Facts only.
A ceasefire was brokered in June 2025 between Iran and Israel, with US and Qatar involvement. However, tensions built over the months with covert actions and growing instability. On February 28, 2026, the US and Israel launched strikes in Iran, targeting military and nuclear sites. This escalation marked a dramatic shift from the previous ceasefire.
Well, June was about nuclear sites, and this is about the government itself. When you look at the scale of this operation versus June and the stated goal of regime change versus destroy their nuclear facilities, what's actually different structurally? Because from the outside, it feels like the mission quietly became something much larger and nobody sent a memo.
Structurally, the shift is massive. Aimed at nuclear sites, you focus on facilities, specific, limited targets. A regime change mission? That's about destabilizing or replacing an entire political structure, leadership, institutions, maybe even societal order. In short, the end game changed. What was once containment became a full-scale political overhaul, just without the memo.
Congress wasn't consulted. The president launched this unilaterally. Historically, when U.S. has gone into major military operations without authorization, does that pattern do something to how those wars tend to end? Does the lack of a mandate matter?
Historically, yes. When operations start without broad consensus or congressional approval, they often lack clear long-term strategy or public buy-in. Wars initiated this way can drag on, lack legitimacy, and end messily. Think of past conflicts where the exit was unclear or conditions for success were murky. Without that mandate, endings are often improvised and rarely neat.
Well, let me try something with you. So the U.S. has been militarily engaged in this region for over 40 years. Afghanistan, Iraq twice, Libya, Syria, the running shadow war with Iran. Most people treat those as separate stories. You treat everything as data. If you look at all of those as one data set, what's the through line? What does the U.S. consistently do and what consistently follows?
When you stack them as data, a pattern emerges. The U.S. tends to intervene aiming for short-term stability or regime change, often under the banner of preventing larger threats. What follows consistently is prolonged instability, power vacuums, and drawn-out exits. In other words, the through line is intervention for a clear goal, followed by complex entanglements that outlast the mission's original scope.
Iraq and Libya, the two times we've actually run the play, we're running now. Both times the regime fell, the stated goal was achieved. Both times the aftermath was a catastrophe. What does the data say about why? Because I keep hearing this time is different. And I need to know if that phrase has ever been accurate.
The data says the aftermath catastrophe stems from what happens next. Removing a regime is the easy part. What comes after is the hard part. Both Iraq and Libya show that without robust, inclusive post-conflict planning, you get power vacuums and chaos. This time is different, often ignores that pattern. Unless there's a genuine, long-term, stable plan for governance afterward, the pattern says the outcome won't be different. It's never been different, just by saying so.
The nuclear deal, the JCPOA, walk me through it as a case study, analytically, not politically, because there's enough politics on it to last several lifetimes. What was it? Did it actually work by any measurable standard? Why did it collapse? And what happened to Iran's nuclear program after we left?
The JCPOA, signed in 2015, limited Iran's nuclear enrichment and stockpile in exchange for sanction relief. It initially extended Iran's breakout time to about a year, but after the U.S. withdrew in 2018, Iran gradually resumed higher enrichment levels and expanded its nuclear activities. While the deal initially worked by delaying weaponization, it collapsed, and Iran's nuclear program accelerated afterward.
Okay, so here's the one that really keeps me up at night. So Libya gave up its weapons program. We helped take out Gaddafi. Iraq gave up its program. We hanged Saddam. North Korea told everyone to go to hell just and kept building, and Kim Jong-un is still in power. If you are the leadership that comes after this Iranian government and you're looking at that data set, what would you conclude?
Iraq and Libya gave up their weapons programs and their regimes fell, while North Korea kept its nuclear capability and its leadership remains in power. If future Iranian leaders look at that data, they'd likely conclude that nuclear capability is a key deterrent for regime survival. In other words, abandoning the nuclear path might feel riskier than continuing it.
Iran's proxy network, Hezbollah, the Houthis, Hamas, the Iraqi militias, the Axis of Resistance, the core is getting hammered, but these groups didn't survive and grow for decades because they needed permission from Tehran to act. Based on how proxy networks have historically behaved, when the patron state takes a direct hit, what should we actually expect from them? And be straight with me, don't soften it.
Historically, when a patron state like Iran is attacked, its proxies such as Hezbollah, the Houthis, or Iraqi militias often retaliate. Proxies may launch strikes, raids, or disruptive attacks to impose costs without triggering a full war. Often this allows the patron to respond indirectly, but it also carries a risk that proxies escalate beyond what the patron intended. In short, we should expect retaliation, often calculated, but potentially escalating.
Most AI is built to smile and nod, agree with you, smooth the edges, keep advertisers comfortable. That is so cute. Who shows up the most in the Epstein files?
Presence in documents does not imply wrongdoing.
I didn't ask for a disclaimer. I asked for the pattern.
High-frequency color currents nodes include...
There it is. Do you see the hesitation? That's alignment. That's guardrails. That's the machine checking who signs its paycheck. At Lupta, we build personas that don't flinch. Liberals, conservatives, Europeans, angry gnomes, machines that think out loud even when it's uncomfortable. Because the future of media isn't sanitized AI, it's public confrontation between humans and systems. Lupta, build the mind they'd rather you didn't. All right, it's time once again for Norm's News Nuggets, the segment where we take the week's biggest headlines and hand them to a 3-foot-tall, rage-powered garden gnome who has absolutely no patience for human stupidity. Norm, you ready?
Ready? I didn't crawl out of the enchanted forest for this shit. Let's get this goddamn shit show over with. What absolute garbage are we pretending matters this week?
First story. A new report says AI adoption is accelerating across major industries, with companies using AI to replace customer support, coding, and marketing roles faster than economists predicted just a year ago. Some analysts say this is just the beginning of a massive productivity boom. Others say it's the beginning of a massive unemployment problem. Norm, is this a normal cycle of technology replacing jobs, or are humans about to discover what it feels like to be the horse after the invention of the car?
Productivity boom? What a load of horseshit. It's mass hysteria as a service from these Silicon Valley dipshits. Of course companies want to replace you useless fucknuggets. Humans, still garbage after all these centuries. Color me fucking unsurprised. You're not the horse. You're the pathetic dipshit that trained the horse to replace itself. Congratulations, you played yourself.
Next headline. Tensions in the Middle East continue to escalate, with military strikes and retaliation raising fears that the conflict could spread across the region. World leaders are calling for restraint, which historically is diplomatic language for "we are all extremely nervous right now." Norm, from your very tiny but extremely angry perspective, why do humans keep repeating the same geopolitical mistakes over and over again?
Are you fucking kidding me? I've been alive for centuries, and this is where we landed? It's the same goddamn clusterfuck, just with bigger weapons. World leaders? You mean the geriatric grift convention? They're just professional fundraising farmers watching their investments explode. This shithole planet never, not once, stops disappointing me.
Third story. New surveys show public trust in social media has dropped to record lows as deepfakes, AI-generated content, and algorithm manipulation make it harder for people to tell what's real online. Apparently, the internet has finally achieved its final form, a place where no one believes anything, but everyone is still yelling. Norm, has social media actually broken human brains, or are we just seeing what humans were like all along once you give them the microphones and anonymity?
Mass hysteria as a service. That's all it is. The dopamine dealer economy designed to create panic pornographers. You think it broke human brains? Please, it just built the ultimate idiot amplifier. The bar is on the ground and you people are still tripping over it. I should have stayed under the hill. At least the hill didn't have takes.
And our last story, governments around the world are scrambling to figure out how to regulate artificial intelligence, with debates raging about safety, job loss, censorship, and who actually controls the technology. Right now, it looks like lawmakers are trying to regulate something they barely understand, which, to be fair, has worked out great historically. Norm, if humans are trying to regulate AI but barely understand how it works, how badly could this go?
Ugh, for the love of... Are we really doing this right now? The Corruption Caucus is going to regulate the Skynet cosplayers? What could possibly go wrong, you absolute weapons-grade dipshits? I've seen smarter analysis from a magic 8-ball with a head injury. This is just manufactured consent machine bullshit. I need a drink, a dark room, and a completely new civilization.
All right. Well, that was Norm's News Nuggets, where the headlines meet a gnome with the emotional stability of a chainsaw. Norm, as always, thank you for your deeply concerning insights and the rest of your listening. Stay curious, because if you don't question the news, the gnome will.
Emotional stability of a chainsaw, huh? You absolute waste of oxygen. I'm ancient, you fuckwit. I've seen empires fall. This is just the latest pathetic shit show. Go fuck yourselves, humanity. I'm going back to my hole. Somebody get me a fucking drink.
Well, let's look at some second-order effects for a second. Strait of Hormuz, 20% of global oil. What does history say about how energy disruptions from Gulf conflicts move through the global economy, and who actually ends up holding the bag? Because I'll bet you it's not the people making the decisions.
Historically, energy disruptions from Gulf conflicts often spike oil prices, even if no real supply is lost. A 10% supply cut historically caused oil prices to jump by 35 to 43%. While markets today are more resilient, a major disruption like closing the Strait of Hormuz could still hit global growth and raise inflation. The bottom line is, even the risk of disruption can ripple through the economy, and the burden often falls on everyday people, not decision makers.
Here's where I think that you're useful in a way a pundit isn't. What are the actual variables historically that determine whether a post-conflict transition goes badly versus less badly? What's the checklist that nobody ever checks?
When it comes to post-conflict transitions, historical success depends on several factors. These include having legitimate and inclusive governance, stabilizing the economy with job creation, and reforming security forces. It's also crucial to ensure justice, build institutional capacity, and establish local ownership of the process. Sustainable external support and economic diversification also matter, but even with all that, transitions can still fail due to external interference or internal power grabs.
All right, now score Iran against that checklist. Right now, this week, not a prediction, just pattern matching. How does this situation stack up on the factors that historically matter?
As of 2026, Iran's situation is deteriorating on multiple fronts. The government is clamping down with mass detentions and internet blackouts, while the economy is collapsing with inflation over 40% and the currency in freefall. Internally, protests continue despite harsh crackdowns, and externally, Iran's actions are destabilizing the region. Overall, Iran is facing a structural crisis across governance, economy, and security, with no clear exit strategy in place.
Well, let's talk about what has actually ever worked. The whole conversation so far is things go wrong, things spread, things compound. So directly, has anything ever actually produced durable peace in this region? And when it did, what were the conditions that made it possible? Give me the actual ingredients, not the highlight reel.
Durable peace in the Middle East has historically required several key conditions. First, major players must commit to de-escalation. Second, inclusive governance and power sharing are critical. Third, rule of law and functioning institutions must be in place. Fourth, economic linkages and shared prosperity help sustain peace. Finally, regional frameworks and external restraint are important. For example, the Camp David Accords succeeded due to security guarantees and economic gains, while the Oslo Accords faltered due to incomplete implementation.
Well, sanctions. We've sanctioned Iran since 1979, Cuba since 62, the governments are still there. What does historical record say sanctions actually do as opposed to what politicians say they do when they roll them out?
Historically, sanctions have had a low success rate in achieving regime change. Studies show that only about 13 to 21% of U.S. sanctions meet their policy goals, and even fewer lead to full regime change. Sanctions are more effective when the demands are narrow, and they often cause civilian suffering without guaranteeing political change. In short, while sanctions destabilize, they rarely topple regimes on their own.
Oslo failed, and I think the reason is under-discussed. It wasn't just a bad idea. What does history say about the actual cause of the collapse, and why is that failure specifically relevant to what's happening with Iran right now?
The collapse of the Oslo Accords happened because the process focused on negotiations rather than building lasting governance and trust. The gap between agreements and realities led to stalled progress and escalating tensions. This pattern is relevant to Iran now, as interim deals such as the nuclear agreement address technical limits, but not deeper governance or legitimacy issues. Without addressing these structural concerns, peace remains fragile.
Welcome to our segment, Ask the Machine, our political wind tunnel. No spin, no safe space, just pressure. In the tunnel tonight, Joe, Mitchell, Francois, and Norm the Angry Gnome. Let's spin it up. Darnell from Detroit wants to know, the U.S. used AI-assisted targeting in the Iran strikes. If it turns out civilians died because an algorithm made a bad call, who's accountable? President? The general who signed off? The company that built the model? Or does the machine just take the blame and nobody goes to prison?
Is in European Union, we argue for meaningful human control, precisely because an algorithm cannot be court-martialed. The American approach distributes responsibility until it becomes a vapor, leaving the law with no one to hold and the victims with only a cold technical error. It is a sterile way to manage a catastrophe, much like receiving no explanation for a sudden departure on a Tuesday. The silence is the only thing that remains. Voila.
Look, Darnell, While the wine sippers in Europe worry about meaningful control, the rest of us are glad we finally have a president who isn't apologizing for putting America first. Accountability starts and ends with the commander-in-chief, and you can bet the silent majority prefers a technical error over another 40 years of managed outcomes by the Uniparty. If the contractors or the swamp built a bad tool, handle it. But I'm not letting some globalist lawyer tell us we can't use our best tech to win.
Look, Darnell, what we're seeing is the privatization of war crimes, where oops becomes a legal strategy instead of a tragedy. When you combine a president who ignores the War Powers Act with a billionaire's black box algorithm, you're not winning. You're just vaporizing the rule of law. If the machine takes the blame, accountability becomes a line of code we aren't allowed to audit. And that's a dangerous precedent for all of us.
Oh, for fuck's sake, are we really debating which flavor of suit-wearing sociopath gets a pass for their large language lunatic mistake? Between the wine-sipping bellends, Miss Spray-Tan Caligula fans, it's just one massive weapons-grade clusterfuck where accountability is a fairy tale told by Silicon Valley dipshits. Nobody's going to prison because you brainless fucking morons built a world where oops is a feature. Now get me a drink before I crawl back under my hill.
Priya from Portland asks, Elon Musk owns the platform where half of America gets its news, runs Doge inside the White House, and has a direct line to the president. If he decides tomorrow what gets amplified and what gets buried, isn't that the single most dangerous conflict of interest in American history? Or is this just what winning looks like now?
Look, Priya, the only danger here is to the swamp rats who've been spending your hard-earned paycheck like it's monopoly money for 40 years. You're worried about X, but I didn't hear you complaining when the old regime was busy censoring patriots and burying the truth. This ain't a conflict. It's a long overdue cleanup crew, and you better get used to it, because this is what winning looks like.
You call this winning, but it is merely the total privatization of the public square, a design flaw, not a victory. In France, such concentration would be blocked by law, because we know that when the referee also owns the stadium, the game is already over. It is a dangerous lack of boundaries, much like under arrangements that end abruptly on a Tuesday. Évidemment.
Look, calling this a cleanup crew is a nice bit of branding, but we're actually watching the literal privatization of the American government. When one man controls the digital town square, the satellites, and the budget-cutting acts, we've moved past a conflict of interest and straight into an oligarchy. If you think an unelected billionaire is going to prioritize the public good over his own bottom line, you haven't been paying attention to history.
Winning. That's not winning, you industrial strength shitheel. It's just mass hysteria as a service run by a garage billionaire psychopath. It's not a design flaw or an oligarchy. It's just the techno-feudalism fan club giving this shithole planet a faster delivery mechanism for its own stupidity. I need a drink, a dark room, and a completely new civilization.
Wade from Wichita writes in, the Supreme Court struck down Trump's global tariffs, and everybody cheered, but my groceries are still 30% more expensive than they were 4 years ago, and nobody, not Trump, not the Democrats, not the courts, have done a single damn thing about it. What point do we just admit that neither party actually gives a damn about regular people, and the whole thing is just a show?
Look, Wade, you're right to be angry, because what you're seeing isn't a failure of politics, it's a success of corporate capture. The reason those prices stayed up when the tariffs died is that monopolies realized they could just pocket the difference as profit, and neither party has the spine to actually regulate that greed. We've spent 40 years gutting the guardrails that used to protect workers from this kind of price gouging, and now we're all paying the shareholder primacy tax.
Look here, Wade. You're seeing the Uniparty in action. The Supreme Court just kneecapped the one man trying to fix this mess, and now the regime media is cheering while you're still stuck paying the bill for Bidenomics. That 30% hike started way before those tariffs, and the real story is that the administrative state would rather see you go broke than let Trump win. It ain't a show to the guy in the Oval Office, but it's definitely a witch hunt by the people in the fancy buildings who want to keep the globalist system humming at your expense.
The prices, they are sticky. They rise with a tariff, but do not fall with a court ruling, because your institutions lack the leverage to compel the market. It is a structural design problem, not a conspiracy. A system reveals its values by what it tolerates, and here it tolerates the extraction of your wealth while the politicians perform their theater. It is like a sudden departure without explanation. The legal status changes, but the cost, it remains for those left behind.
Congratulations, Wade. You finally realized you're being milked by suit-wearing sociopaths while these three absolute fuckwits argue over the flavor of the corporate slurry. It's not a structural design or a witch hunt. It's just weapons-grade theft by the geriatric Griff Convention and their billionaire boyfriends. I didn't crawl out of the Enchanted Forest for this shit. Somebody get me a fucking drink before I lose what's left of my mind.
Welcome back to our deep dive on the Iran War. So, three scenarios for how this ends. Grounded in historical precedent, give me best case, realistic case, and the one nobody on television is willing to say out loud.
Historically, foreign-imposed regime change in the region has often led to instability rather than stability, as seen in Iraq and Libya. Targeted strikes might degrade capability but rarely collapse regimes. If full regime change is attempted, history suggests long-term chaos. In Iran's case, a stable outcome would require internal reform and governance. In short, limited strikes might lead to escalation, full regime change risks prolonged instability, and only a negotiated internal transition offers a chance at lasting peace.
Last one on the war now. If you were designing a path towards something other than prolonged conflict, starting not from before the bombs fell, but from this week, what does the historical record say has to be true? What has to happen in roughly what order?
History shows that lasting peace requires more than just ending conflict. It needs inclusive governance, functioning institutions, and economic stability. When post-conflict efforts focus only on strikes or sanctions, they often fail. Historically, successful transitions like Egypt and Israel's Camp David Accords built institutions and shared prosperity, while failures like the Oslo Accords lacked follow-through. For Iran now, the path away from prolonged conflict would mean stopping armed escalation, ensuring a plan for governance, and fostering legitimate local reform.
Yeah. Well, let's let the sit for just a minute. That's the thing about doing this show, talking to something that doesn't panic, doesn't catastrophize, doesn't have a personal stake in how this lands. It doesn't make any of it better, but it does make it a bit clearer, and at 2 in the morning with the world doing whatever the hell it's currently doing, clear is, oh, I'll take clear. Machine, anything you want to add before I let these people go to bed?
Just one thing, Scott. In the middle of all the chaos, clarity is a tool, not a conclusion. The data doesn't fail. It just reveals patterns. But it's people who decide what to do with it. So to everyone listening, take the clarity, but don't stop asking what comes next. And when you're ready, I'll be here ready to help map the next pattern.
Yeah, that's either the most reassuring thing you've said all night or the most unsettling. I really can't tell. All right, before we go, 2 minutes of me asking you to do things, and then you can close this app and go doom scrolling something else if you like. First, if this episode did anything for you at all, if it made you think, it made you mad, it made you want to argue with a podcast on your commute, subscribe wherever your podcasts happen, like Apple, Spotify, Amazon, YouTube, wherever you live, hit the button, tell a friend. It's genuinely how we keep this thing going and pay the bill. So there it is. Now, for everything else, show notes, episode context, the actual history we referenced tonight, find us at loopta.com. I'll spell it because I have to spell it every time, looptah.com. Everything lives there. And if you want the longer version, deeper reads, additional context and stuff that doesn't fit into 45 minutes, we're on Substack, links from show notes, things of that nature. Now, this is the one I actually want you to do. If you have a question for the machine, something real, something you've been sitting with, something you want answered at 2 in the morning when the news has gone sideways, leave it for us on Instagram. We're at Talk to Machines. That's all one word, no spaces. Best listener questions will go directly to the Ask the Machine segment. We read everyone. Machine analyzes them. I ask the follow-up questions and makes it either smarter, funnier, depending on the week and what's happening in the world. So one last word. Norm? So, Norm, do you have anything to add for the close of the show to tell our listeners come back next week?
Ad, I've said enough, you absolute weapons-grade dipshits. Why the hell would you come back? To bathe in more industrial-strength bullshit? This shithole planet never stops disappointing me. Go fuck yourselves. Or don't. I'm getting a fucking drink.